everybody, and welcome to Lens Flare 35. This is Dave Horner, and today we're going to talk to photographer Dirk Fletcher. Dirk's personal work centers on transportation, industry, and things that are big and cool. He's personally concerned with the achievability of a family's personal history. As society has shifted from film cameras to cell phones to record birthdays, holidays, and other family events, the days of finding a dusty box of history in Grandma's attic are numbered. 7 years ago, Dirk was hired by Harrigan's College of Design to build the first new program offered in the school's 75-year history, blending commercial photography with digital video. So, Dirk, that's a great intro. Welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be here.
Finally, after us not connecting one time and finally connecting again and all of that technical stuff, right?
More technical it is, the more things have to get.
The more things can break, right?
Exactly. The more chances for something to go completely haywire.
I know. Well, hopefully we'll get this one under the wings. So, you know, I was really interested in reading all that you talked about as far as Grandma's attic, and it got me thinking about it. So why the concern about what we're going to find in the future in the attic?
One thing, and I've got a couple different kind of soapboxes that I talk about, and the biggest one is I come from a commercial photography background, and I think commercial photographers, once digital came along, they knew how to manage the workflow and get, you know, an image through the camera and deliver to a client because the paycheck depended on it. But then as soon as everyone's cell phone started, I was at PMA, which is Photo Marketing Association. They've got a big trade show every year, and I was in the Canon booth. One of the representatives said, well, we're never going to make a pocket camera with a that records smaller than, I want to say it was like 6, because cell phones inside of 2 years are gonna have that, you know, be able to create a file that big. And sure enough, and that was like 2 years ago, and I actually forgot all about that. And now with everyone using iPhones, cell phones, and BlackBerry, that is truly the way we communicate and the way I always ask students in my class, how many times have you been to a wedding or gone to visit someone in the hospital that's had a baby? And you phone and you put them up on Facebook, and it's truly wonderful because people on the other side of the world can see something instantly. For people, you'd have to go, you know, go to Sam's Club or Walgreens, prints made, send them out, and, you know, if someone saw them within a month, it was cool. But the downside of that is that no one is really archiving forward. So all of these images are now digital, and we've been, you know, since we were little kids, beaten into submission that, you know, don't throw away negatives. The negative is very, very important. And so regardless of what you do to it, you either throw it in a box, you throw it in a drawer, you throw it somewhere, but you generally don't throw away negatives. You might throw prints away, but you've got this box that's found in the attic, and you'll go, you know, you'll be at a family reunion, and they'll be like, oh, God, you look like Uncle Ponzi, and they go rifle through a box or a photo album, and out comes this old photograph, and sure enough, you look like whoever it is, or you don't, but you're able to find that. And I think that as families are looking at kind of recording a social history or having that history that truly is important. I used to work in museums, so I had that kind of ingrained in as well. But I think that as we're, you know, how many stories have you heard where all my laptop was stolen or the hard drive crashed and they had all my pictures on it? And when you start thinking about having babies and milestones in someone's life, oh, you buy a house or you buy a car, you take pictures of it. And those are all the moments that I think are in jeopardy with everyone using cell phones to record, to use history.
Well, especially these days, with some of the applications that are coming out, like there are a couple of new ones, one called Iris and one called 100 Cameras. You know, people are actually turning out some incredible photos with these applications on the iPhone. It's amazing.
Videos as well.
I know.
One on the Apple site, I forgot who it was, but just did a feature film on the iPhone.
I know, isn't that amazing?
It is awesome. My kids are totally into it. We make films. You know, I love the fact that they'll be like, let's make a movie, and out comes the dry erase board, and they start storyboarding, and they're able to edit now on a phone, which is something that, you know, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, just to put to shoot a couple takes on a scene, and you know, butt that up against one take you did an hour earlier, would have either cost a fortune or, you know, had a bunch of VCRs and it would have looked horrible. And now for a $5 editing app, you can do it on the phone, and it's amazing.
I know. Well, won't we find CDs or DVDs up there in the attic? I mean, if we're taking that step and we're archiving those, well, why not find them?
I think that over 10 years, the data on them, when they first came out, they were making the gold DVDs, they were making a huge stink about them. And the amount of thickness of the material that was actually recording the was holding the information was much, much thicker than it is now. Now the costs are so cheap that the DVDs, you can really only, I don't know, having about 10 years worth of life on them. I just got, I went to school in Santa Barbara, and as color labs are kind of folding up all over the country, I wanted to have some film. I was testing with the Wide Lux, and I sent some film out to them. The local labs weren't in Sam's Club, wasn't doing a great job either. I hate to admit that they're Sam's Club, but they're remarkably good. But the so I sent some stuff out, and in the disc I got back from them was a little slip of paper that says, "Professional MAM A Professional Series Silver DVD. Their CDR is the, you know, finest for longevity." And this whole list of, you know, don't, you know, put an adhesive label on it, handle it by the edges only, store it vertically in a protected case. And that's the only one that I wasn't sure about that I wanted to look into. But the, you know, you want to make sure that when you put a DVD or CD away, you don't use a marker on it. You write for leave for it. And then you also, they're very light sensitive, so if you put them in a dark drawer, that'll help them last a little bit longer too. But really, over 10 years, you can't guarantee that any of the material is going to be there. There are lawsuits that have, you know, that action suits that take, you know, 10, 12, 15 years to fruition. And unless that data is moved forward onto a new medium or even just onto a different DVD, not going to be there. It seems, you know, you might have a floppy disk that has on there, but you can't buy a computer now that has a floppy. Still have a glass plate negative. You can hold it up to the sky and see that information on there. So it's a whole new kind of world that every 8 or 10 years you've got to take this whole mass of data and move it forward. And I don't think families are doing that, or they're not thinking like that yet.
Didn't they tell us those things were going to last 100 years when they came out?
They're going to last forever, absolutely. And
I think I remember that, right?
My very first digital camera was a Nikon. It was using the original RAW format, which now if you try to open it, or the Kodak, you know, before cameras were affordable, we were all getting the Kodak scan. And that software, you can't, the files don't open. So even if the data is there, the files don't open, and you know, you don't want to think that any of these companies that are, you know, Adobe and Canon and Nikon, that you want to think they're going to be around forever, but you have no idea. It could be the next Enron where, you know, there could be some back, you know, something goes on and the company disappears and all of a sudden, you know, all of our ACR files aren't going to open.
Or the DNG that they're telling us is going to be the answer will go away, right?
It'll be the answer for now, and there'll be something else in 5 years, I guarantee it.
Oh, man.
And it's just a matter of, just, you got to stay on top of it. And if you know what's going on, and, you know, I got a redundant drive system about a year and a half, 2 years ago at Drobo, and that's nice because it's like, as soon as it's on there, I feel comfortable that the data, the hard drive's not going to crash. And it's just a matter of, you know, if you do everything on a laptop, just make sure you regularly burn. You burn backups, and you know, my thing is just print everything out, especially family stuff. You know, just get in the habit of, you know, you go to a birthday party, upload it to whatever lab you use. Even the internet labs, they're fine. As long as there's some manufacturers that are doing like inkjet prints when you go to like the drugstore, and those aren't as good. But if you know, a lot of them are just the Fuji, you know, the Frontera printers, and you know, that print will last. It will last years and years, and you just got to get in the habit of printing stuff out and making, you know, throwing the family album.
Yeah. Well, you're so interested in this that you're making a movie about it, right?
I did. That was my thesis film.
Okay.
At school. And it was cool. I interviewed Dirk Halstead, who shot the famous picture of Clinton hugging the woman who made the braids. But there was the story that he had was there were four of the photographers in the little press pool, and everyone shot that photo, but he was the only one that was still shooting with film. And they would get in the van, they would go back to the press pool, the van would go back to the White House, and everyone would kind of chimp through their files and throw the good stuff away, throw the good stuff, you know, upload those or put them on their computer, and then when they get back, they would move those to the wire services. And all the bad ones, no one was thinking far enough ahead that, okay, all these images saved the entire shoot. I saw the documentary on Graphic a couple weeks ago. I was down in St. Louis with my dad, and we watched the documentary on the White House photographer now. He said that he's bound by law that everything he shoots is saved, is recorded. And before this all came, he had a wonderful story. Halstead had a great story about how wire services didn't want to switch over to digital yet because the editors were going to lose control of the edit. But all of a sudden, the photographer, where they would send back, you know, a half dozen rolls of film, and they would have all these images to pick from, they're going to edit, and they're going to upload, you know, six shots. Here's this event that I shot, or here's this. So I talked to Halstead. I talked to a friend of mine, a high school friend, who was the guy who, Eric Siegel, who bought all of his family pictures from his second child being born because the laptop got stolen. He was out of town, and someone broke in and stole his laptop, and that's the time story where it's something so simple. It's like, yeah, I just had them all on, and now he uses, has them in a couple different places.
Well, do you think you're going to be able to influence people's opinion about the media they use for images then? I mean, are you preaching to anybody who's listening, or what do you think?
I preach to my students because they have to listen stuck in the room for 4 hours. So they're definitely hearing my message. And it's something I talk about. I don't think I'm going to change anything, but it's something I want people to be aware of. You know, we travel like a lot of families do for the holidays. And I had a Canonette with me, and I shot, you know, a couple, probably half dozen rolls of film. I shot a ton of digital, and, you know, I even shot with my phone and my digital camera, and, you know, I've got a small one I carry with me. But it's still, you know, opening presents and some of the more monumental stuff. I'd shoot a couple frames of film, and, you know, I just dropped it at Sam's Club, got the prints back, and we've got those negatives, so we've got those. So I want people to be aware of it more than anything because I truly don't feel like people, and there's been a solution yet that helps people take these files and just keep them forward compatible. A while back, I thought, how great would it be to have a service, an online service, where you just upload everything to it and, you know, 20 years later and say, oh, this person, there's this great picture at a wedding, and can we get a print of that? And I think in the film days, it was easier because you had an album with pictures, and then if you're lucky enough, the album had the little pocket in the back where you threw negatives in there. Or at least you had the print. You can go scan it and get a new print of it. Where with digital, there are all these files everywhere, and I'm just as guilty as anyone else. You know, I've got a laptop and a desktop and a machine at work, and I've got stuff everywhere. And that was my 2011 resolution, was to get all the images and get all the family stuff consolidated in a much more solid workflow.
So since you're recommending all this film stuff, what kind of cameras are you telling these people to go out there and get? Old ones, you know, old refurbished kind of Canons and Nikons, or what?
They're cheaper. They could not be any cheaper. I've got a someone at work actually brought in a Yashica, like a rangefinder. Lens doesn't come off. It's got built-in meter. I'm a diehard Canon person. I picked up a Canonette on from the local store. It's $69, and razor sharp. Incredibly sharp. But I've been looking at other Canon stuff, but a lot of I don't want to say there's no need for it anymore, but man, it's never been cheaper. If you've priced a Hasselblad and an 80 and a back, it's the best time in the world to get into medium format if you want to go that direction, just because there's so much equipment out there and so many people have switched to digital and just kind of abandoned film. And I still shoot, you know, I've got a ton of digital gear. The Mark II is, I think, the greatest camera ever made. And
we could agree on that, you know.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. And on my website, I don't think anything, any of my current work and any of my commercial work, it's all digital. It's been all digital. But the, you know, just for family stuff and just goofing around, I am actually using a wide lux now. I think wide lux, my calf frame cameras that are, you know, out there. Some of the, there are some stuff that digital still can't do. And there's some of those images out, but for the most part, I think I'm playing with those old. Do you remember the Pentax 110 system that was like a SLR system?
Oh yeah, yeah.
I was shooting with that like crazy for a couple of years. Just it was still, you know, fit in your pocket, and then you know I was trying to scan it as big as possible and make huge prints where the grain was just textured, and it was really fun to play with. But you can pick all the stuff up for you know, peanuts. On I mean, thank God for eBay. I don't know what I'd do at night.
Well, you know. With the last Kodachrome chemicals being available, do you think we're in danger of not being able to process the film? You're telling everybody go out and shoot it, pick up a medium format film camera?
I think so. Unfortunately, I think so. I mean, I think it's a losing battle. Mm. I think for the next 5 years, though, we're all safe. After that, I wouldn't know. You know, in the and the funny thing is too, I'm walking the line on being a collector. You see all this stuff out there, and you're like, oh, I gotta have this. And then you're like, why? And what am I gonna do with it? Put it in a cabinet and look at it?
Yeah, why not?
The original F1 with the 51.2. God, it's a beautiful camera. And you're like, then I'll shoot it at Christmas and birthdays. And, you know, do I really need a, you know, I mean, you can get a beautiful $400. Do I really need to spend, you know, for $80 or $50, get a, you know, a Canon, that the little rangefinders, like I said, they are just, they're right. We're trying to figure out at the school how to buy 20 of them so we can literally on the first day of a particular class give them a paper bag with some kind of 35mm camera and a couple rolls of film. And for the first couple weeks, they don't even touch digital until they, you know, it's still, it's so much, as a teaching tool, just aperture, shutter speed, it's almost easier to teach it on film than it is with digital.
Do you realize how many of those students coming in have never even seen film?
Yeah. You want to hear a funny story? We have a wonderful history class that's very hands-on. It's more than just a history of photographers and kind of famous pictures. It's a history of the technology. And as a final project, students can either recreate a process or they can write a paper. So being all visual people, I don't think anyone has ever written a paper. Everyone wants to build something or go do something that, you know, out of the old days. And someone said, I want to try this toning. It seems really cool. And the pictures are great. And we took students over to the Art Institute, and they opened their doors to the print archives and pull stuff out for us. And she comes into class and goes, you know, I did everything, and it's black. It's just right blown black. And the teacher, incredibly smart guy, Ed Wesley, goes, oh, he looks at it, and I don't know. It does seem like everything should be right. You know, bring everything in, and we'll take a look at it next class. And she tried selenium toning an Epson print, which we all know will apparently turn black now. And that same token, we've had Photoshop instructors. Now the kids coming out of high school, they're all dry darkrooms. Mm-hmm. So they don't know why the Dodge tool and the Burn tool look the way they do. I was in the lab one day, and someone said they were talking about making a face brighter, and they said, just click on the sucker. And I was like, what? They're like the sucker tool, the thing that looks like a lollipop. And I was like, oh.
Sucker tool.
Yeah, click on the sucker, so it's stuck. I call it the sucker ever since.
Oh, jeez.
Well, do you think this proliferation of virtually every electronic device we've got being able to take a picture, I mean, even the rumors of the next iPad having front and rear facing cameras, do you think it's going to just lessen the overall importance of images and professional images in particular?
I absolutely think you're dead on. My father's photographer, I literally grew up in a dark room with him. So my first memories were me sitting on a stool, my brother sitting to the right of me at the fixer. I was at the rinse, and Dad would make a print and develop it and pass it to me. And that was literally, I mean, I've been around this forever. And it's kind of sad because there is a lot of the how people make a living making pictures is completely different than it was. And it made changes, you know, from really when I started paying attention to it in the early 90s, early 80s, probably, you know, 70. I graduated high school in 87, so, you know, you count back maybe 10 years from that when I was in the darkroom. And it made changes, and lenses came out, and they were cool and stuff, but it wasn't until digital came out that just the bottom dropped out. And, you know, before you'd have a couple F3s and some lenses, or, you know, Hasselblad and a couple lenses and some backs and, you know, some lights, and you're kind of in business. You buy Kodachrome, and you go out and you come back and send your film away, and back came these beautifully amazing, sharp, brilliantly colorful transparencies, and you'd give them to the printer, and they knew exactly what they looked like, and you know, they'd hold it up to the light box and look at the printed pieces that came off the press, and it matched and great, and everyone's happy. And now with digital, there's so much other stuff that goes along with it. You now have to be a photo archivist and a keyworder, and they, you know, you've got to know Photoshop and Lightroom, and you've got to have, you know, if you're shooting in the studio, you're going to most likely capture tethered, and there's all this other stuff that goes with it. And so a lot of the older photographers are, they're either finding a certain niche or, unfortunately, they're getting out of it. I've had so many people in Chicago that have called me up and said, you know, do you want some equipment? I'm getting out. I'm going to, you know, sell real estate or do whatever it is that they're going to do. And, you know, I'd like to see the equipment used. And unfortunately, that's happened 3 times now with pretty prominent photographers that are just, that just don't want to play the game and keep up. Especially with like digital coming in or digital video coming in, and it's now another, you know, some people view it as, oh, now I'm going to have to learn how to do this. And I'm just a geek with everything, and I'm, oh, this is awesome. I'm, you know, making movies on my phone, and, you know, the, when I was looking for grad school, I knew I wanted to do digital video because the two sides are combining so fast. And you look at prominent photographers and how they're working both of them into a business or into their kind of what they can offer a client. It's really, I think it's an exciting time because I don't know where it's going. You know, we can all kind of see the writing on the wall that there's going to be a lot more motion. And you know, when the internet and everyone was having websites, there were some photographers that started doing, you know, HTML and web and Flash stuff, and that seemed really small compared to the amount of people now that are doing digital video and being able to provide that to clients.
So how do we get just kind of rise above all this? Are we all going to be turning our cameras over to you? Should we get your address here in the podcast and just send your equipment? Or
I'll take it, absolutely, DirkFletcher.com. I think a lot of it comes back to, and this is something else that I kind of preach in the classroom. One photographer that I really respect and have a lot of admiration for is Joe McNally.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think he kind of, whether he knew it or not, he saw this coming. My other soapbox is that lighting is always going to be lighting, and the ability to light an egg or a diamond ring or, you know, someone's face isn't going to change whether you're shooting 8x10 or you're shooting a Rolleiflex or you're shooting a 5D. That the ability to take a round face and make it look round or make it look narrow, or how you apply light and where you apply light, that's not going to change. But I think where we're heading with this, with the cameras, and you look at how ISOs are, you know, both Canon and Nikon have products now that are coming out that are in the 100,000s, which is crazy. And yeah, they're grainy and you wouldn't think to use them, but we regularly use 1600 now. And in the first generation of digital cameras, 1600 looked like what 1000 looks like now. So I think we're getting to the point where you're going to be able to light anything with a couple duffel bags full of, you know, speed lights, and you'll still need, you know, a softbox or an umbrella or something to change the size of the light source. But the quantity of light that we need is diminishing. I mean, as we're talking, you know, I think in the next two generations of cameras, in the next couple of years, we're going to see crazy speeds that just look gorgeous. And so what's really going to separate people is are people that look at photography as a kind of back, I want to say going full circle, where you look at like how George Harrell would light a face. And it's that kind of stuff that everyone, you know, slapping a ring light on the front of a camera and calling yourself a fashion photographer just isn't going to make it anymore, that you're going to have, you know, pay attention to how you light and what your lighting can do to the subject. And I think that's what will separate people out. But these are hard skills that, that truly will last a lifetime, you know, having the ability to you know, define shape and texture with light has kind of been the challenge of photographers all along, along with other stuff. But having that in your toolbox really makes it a lot easier. And I think that's something that will never go away if we're using a phone or if we're using a, you know, an 8x10 camera, which incidentally are dirt cheap as well. I played with an 8x10 cameras a couple months ago because you almost couldn't afford time to. It's like $300.
Oh, well, and speaking of lighting and dummies at the same time.
All in the same breath. Isn't that funny?
All in the same breath. You were talking about lighting, and I was like, man, so lighting for dummies. Tell me about it.
Really, really fun project. I started out, the whole thing came about in such a weird kind of happenstance way. My mom wrote a cookbook. My mom's the only non-creative person in the family, although... Well, she's probably going to call me now.
She's cooking, and you call her non-creative?
Oh. Okay, Mom, this is for you. The Art of Cook, theartofchef.com is her blog, or the art, Google Helen Fletcher. But she's a commercial baker. She's a pastry chef in St. Louis. She's on Channel 4 once a week. And... she's the only one. My dad's a retired photographer. My brother is a Steadicam operator in Hollywood. But in 1986, my mom wrote a book called The New Pastry Chef, which was a I grew up eating like baklava and croissants, and it's wonderful. My grandmother on my mom's side was a wonderful cook, and made all these wonderful. They were all, you know, butter laden, horrible for you, but God, everything was great. And what my mom did was she took all of these old school Eastern European recipes and she made them more modern. And The New Pastry Cook was a book about using the food processor to make croissants a lot faster. You know, to do them for real, it takes 2 days to make them, and now you can do them in a couple hours with this book she did in 86. So she had a commercial bakery, and she closed that down at the beginning of this year, and she started, she wanted to do another cookbook. And so she retained an agent who, through the course of their conversation, said, you know, your husband's a retired photographer. I know there's some photo titles. Would he be interested in writing a book? And she said, well, no, but my son might. I was just done with grad school, so I did something back and forth with the agent, who then signed me and said, all right, it's a dummy project. And I was thinking to myself, at one point I even said, well, as long as it's not one of those yellow dummies books. and then all the testing, and I did some writing tests and stuff, and they said, it is a dummies project. And I was like, all right. And I read a half dozen of these books, and I realized that there are few series in the bookstores and on the internet that have such distilled down really good information in really quick kind of nuggets, understandable, ADD friendly, digestible nuggets of information that the more people I talked to, the more people were like, God, if you know, that is so perfect for you, because I kind of just spew when I start talking. And one of the things that then working with the editors at Wiley that they said was, you know, you want all the tone and demeanor of the book to seem like you're talking to your six best friends and you're giving them a hint or you're giving them a tip. And I'm like, oh, well, that I can definitely do. And so it was a crazy deadline late in the year. And we got through it. And the funny thing was the pictures are all... they're all around my neighborhood, and I was able to pull a lot of pictures from some of the students at school, which, I mean, it was a wealth of really talented students at Harrington. So those are spread through the book, and it's really fun. I told students that it's the closest thing to a Cliff Notes that they're going to get for a couple of the classes there, but it is a real specific or kind of a technical approach to lighting. We cover everything from lighting tabletops, people, even cars are in there, but it's a real kind of a commercial approach to lighting just a myriad of different subjects and a myriad of different surfaces and everything from mirrors to one of the great, I do a, to show kind of the example of going from a real small hard source, like a, you know, just a single flash, to a giant 6-foot diffusion panel, is I use a basketball and one of those glazing balls out of the backyard, and that's actually out of my neighbor's backyard. And so I hopped over the fence and grabbed it and went down to the studios and I shot overnight and brought back, and I told my actors what I did, but it was a perfect example because it's like this, the shiny blue, ball-looking thing next to a basketball, and it really told the story. So it's a lot of fun, and it's been wonderful. I just, this morning I got an email from someone in the U.K., read the book, and they had a question. I was able to clarify for them, and it's been really, really fun. I never thought, if someone told me a year ago I would have done this, I wouldn't have believed it, but I couldn't be any happier that it is.
Well, I haven't ever read a Dummies book, but I'm going to have to get yours. So
I think you'll enjoy it. It is literally, it's if you imagine, any of the major commercial photo schools, Brooks, RIT, Pasadena, any of the big programs, it is, if you take their lighting content and distill it into little, digestible sound bites, this would be it. For $20 on Amazon, I don't think you can do any better.
No. So what's been the most unexpected outcome from doing that book?
Hearing from people that I've gotten emails, and I made a point to put my website and my blog in there because I'd love for people, if I confused them or if there's something in there that they want more information on. And, there's all this rush up to the deadlines and just craziness that goes on, and then there's this, gigantic quiet, and it came out a little before Christmas, and then just in the past couple of weeks, I've started getting emails from people. There was a gentleman from Ohio who emailed and said, I teach continuing ed, and I checked your book out from the library, and I read it, and I liked it so much, I went and I bought a copy, and I'm putting it on my suggested reading list, and, I just wanted to tell you thanks. And and then this morning, I got an email from someone in the UK who wanted clarification on one of the lighting techniques I talked about, and it was great because I fired back an answer right away, and he's like, oh, that's awesome. Fired back another question, I love teaching photography. There's nothing that inspires me more than taking pictures and sharing that excitement with other people, and this has been able to really reach a whole lot of people that I would have never been able to reach just with the website and the blog, so it's just been wonderful.
Well, how did you end up teaching photography then? How did that transition take place?
I was a photographer at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago for 5 years. And through that time, I went to Brooks Institute in Santa Barbara. And I kept in touch with a couple of my professors. And they were in the process of growing. And my wife and I went out there and looked at possibly moving out there to teach early on. And I don't know if you'd price real estate in Southern California.
I try not to.
Oh, man, it's insane. We would have been living at the YMCA, we realized. Yeah. And so we said, no. And then, probably 5 years later, 4 years later, Brooks started, we're owned by Harrington is owned by the same company that Brooks is owned by. And so they started looking at how to, I don't want to say syndicate, but take their curriculum and get it outside of Santa Barbara. And they were looking at major markets, and one of them was Chicago. And so when they, and just by luck of the draw, the instructor that I had stayed in touch with, just one of my favorite instructors, David Litchell, I kept in touch with him since graduation. And there were probably half a dozen of them. Harry Lyles was another one that I've kept in touch with. But he was kind of overseeing that project and said, we're doing this this program in Chicago, and you should come in and think about being a part of it. And I was on the, they put me on the advisory board early on, and then I went into interview with who is now actually the president of Brooks, Sue Kirkman. And I'm sitting in her office, and we're interviewing, and I thought I was there to interview to be a teacher there. And about halfway through the interview, I realized that I was interviewing for the department chairman position and the person that would be, like, starting up the program. And had I known that going in, I probably would have been so nervous I would have botched the whole thing. But it was so funny because I was, like, halfway through, I'm like, oh. And it just, you know, 18 interviews later, it worked out that they awarded me with the job, and it's been a wonderful experience to start something from scratch. I mean, I think we started with 12 students 7 years ago in May of 04, and now we've got over, I want to say about 200 students, and we just started a bachelor's program in this fall. It was the first semester that we're enrolling people in both an associate's and a bachelor's program. So it's been it's really been fun to see the light go off and to see students. And for the beginning, you really don't know much until students start getting out there. And you know, even in a 2-year program or 19 months, it took a while to get students to go through the program before you start seeing how they fare when they get out in the world. And we've got students that are doing some great stuff and doing some great work, which is really a source of pride to see that they've come through. And we've got a whole faculty of commercial photographers and kind of practicing photographers, which is nice because it's one thing to be able to teach a certain technique and any number of people I could teach, you know, how to shoot black glass or how to shoot a mirrored cube or a toaster, which is like pretty much anything in the world. A toaster could be a car or a cup of coffee, you know, anything that's silver and reflective. And I can teach someone how to do that, but to have someone that makes a living doing that, In this climate, in this environment, is really a benefit to the student because, as we talked about earlier, the industry is changing so quick. We don't know where it's going, and to have people, you know, practicing professionals in the classroom really helps.
Where do you think the, you know, in this change now we're seeing all of this video in the cameras? Where do you think this is going to take us? Because you've kind of embraced that already, correct?
Absolutely. I think you have to, like it or not. It's kind of like if you remember when PageMaker came out, all of a sudden there was this glut of horrible design where, like, everyone was instantly a designer and they were, you know, everything looked like a ransom note. It had 15 different fonts on it, and every bell and whistle that the program would do was like, look at my newsletter. And it was like, whoa. And then it took a while for that industry to realize, okay, you know, we can't have someone, you know, in the office, or like you look at corporations and how they would use to outsource that. And they said, okay, well, now maybe we don't need to hire someone. We can just buy the software and we can do it. To realize that it really is worthy to hire someone. A friend of mine here in town, Bob Tolchin, tells a story about a client that he had shot for years and years, and then he lost him as a client because someone, you know, they had we've got a digital camera and it's not as good as, you know, what you do, but I think it's good enough for what we're doing. And after 2 years of putting out, I want to say it was the annual report, whatever publication it was, they called him back and they said, you know what, you're you know, we need a professional. And you know, what we were doing, and the first one comes out, and it probably doesn't look that different, or, you know, it looks different enough that they're going, oh, yeah, it's a new direction we're going. And then they see the second one, you start comparing them to someone that's made a living, you know, shooting executives or shooting, you know, doing that, and it truly makes a difference. And I think the same thing is going on with digital video, but the wonderful advantage with that is before there was this almost like an entry that was out of reach of most people. You know, even to shoot something on 16mm and edit it was something that, you know, the neighborhood kids weren't going to be able to do together. And now, you know, regardless of what platform you're using, you know, Final Cut, Premiere, iMovie, it, to be able to see how what people are capable of. And I think that the next, you know, I don't know if we're going to find the next Spielberg, but I, there's a chance we will, that so many people can now do this that were never able to do it before, that I think you can't not embrace it and at least and play with the tools and see what's capable. And with the 5D, that truly is an absolute, you know, I'm not positive Canon knew what they were doing. They had this wonderful product. They said, "Oh, we're giving you live view. We can save that for you to look at it later." And really what they were doing is saying, we now have a full-size chip that's going to give you video. Well, that was the barrier before in feature films. And being able to get a real cinematic look was everything was shot on a quarter inch or, you know, a third of an inch chip, which the whole world's in focus and it looks like a camcorder. Well, now all of a sudden you can shoot the final episode of House on a DSLR and looking at it on your TV set in your living room, you're not going to be able to tell the difference. That there's an awful lot of post-production that goes into it. I don't want to give people the impression that, you know, go get a 5D and you'll make films. But the camera now is $2,500 to shoot something capable of doing that, where before that camera was $150,000. And, yeah, you're going to have to learn Final Cut and you're going to have to learn color grading and you're going to have to learn all this stuff. But you can wander into the Apple store and $5,000 later you can get it. And where before it was truly hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm doing an independent study now with one of my students and wants to do film, and I had him read the Rebel Without a Crew. I don't know if you've read it. It's a really fun book. It's a Robert Rodriguez story on how he made El Mariachi.
Yeah, I haven't read that one.
It's fun. It's you know, I couldn't put it down, and I'm not usually like that. I usually, like, read to pass time or on the train or something, and I couldn't stop. And it talks about, and he made it, you know, 15 years ago, where he really was jumping through hoops, and he was giving blood to get money to get the film out of the lab and stuff. And I'm thinking, if you take that kind of drive and that kind of effort and just that yearning to make a film, but you have the material or the resources now or the equipment now to do it, what's possible? You know, what can these people that are, you know, he's gone on to enjoy a wonderful, you know, very successful career because he's got that drive in him. But God, and he's explained with the SLRs and shooting with the 5D and the 7D. But we had Alex, I'm going to butcher his last name, Bueno, he came to Harrington, who shoots the Saturday Night Live, the commercial,
yeah.
The faux commercial and the intro thing. Does all that with 5Ds and 7Ds. And, you know, he did a great job talking to the students saying, this is a tool and you've got to learn it because this is the perfect tool for some jobs. Other jobs, you're going to need a different tool, but being able to know this and know how this works and its strengths and weaknesses, I'm able to get done, you know, inside of the commercial parody format. They've got, you know, a day to shoot, and they've got, you know, real limited time on locations. This is absolutely the perfect tool. If I came in there with an Aeroflex or Panavision, it would just take too long, and I wouldn't be able to get the end product done. And kind of learning its limitations is such an advantage to people that I think, you know, if you've got video on your camera and you haven't flipped that button just to try it, you've got, you know, 60% of your camera you haven't used yet. So I would encourage everyone just to go out with the kids and just goof around with it and see what it's capable of, because it is pretty mind-blowing.
Well, you mentioned that your boys are filmmakers too. I mean, how did that happen? Was it just because they are around you a lot? And what are they working on?
Oh, man, it is so cool to see them work on stuff. They're literally like, oh, let's make a film. Like I said earlier, they whip out the dry erase board and they'll storyboard before they go out and shoot, because that way they'll know, all right, well, we got to have this shot, and then if we're going from there to there, we got to end over here. And they really think in terms of scenes, and which is something that, you know, with the technology, we started doing it. I had an FX1 Sony camcorder when I was in school, and so it was a big camera for them, but they were able to get their head around how to use it and what to do with it. Now we're mostly just using the iPhone, because then we'll shoot it and edit right on the phone, and then you can upload it right from there at 720p. It's crazy, but they are they do everything. We had 2 feet of snow yesterday, and Sam, my oldest, was upstairs taping his Nerf guns, taping all the holes on them, so we can go out in the snow tomorrow. We got another snow day, and we can do a war movie out in the snow. And they've got a group of friends. friends that are the Magus's that are, and ironically, they were doing the same thing before they met him. And every summer, this family would make a film, and now they'll go ahead play dates, and they'll come back. And I don't know what it is about kids in this age and kind of the older grade school age. Everything's a war movie, or everything ends with people blowing up and dying. And with Boy Scouts, we did a film that was, it started out, it's called Crosstown Killers, and it was the Cubs versus the Sox, and then it turned into a war. So it starts out with Cubs versus Sox, and then there's a museum, a First Infantry Museum here in Chicago that we filmed it at, so there are all these tanks and stuff we're able to hang off and shoot, and it was really fun. It's fun to work with students to expose them to doing something like that. You know, I went a couple nights prior to us filming, and we talked about, you know, I even did a little bit of lighting with them, like how, you know, if you shoot backlit, you know, they're going to look like this, and their eyes aren't going to be squinted, but if they're looking with the sun kind of over your shoulder, kind of the Kodak info sheet method of shooting, their eyes are going to be squinted, and just how to, you know, with reflectors and a scrim, how they can drastically change stuff. So it was really cool when we were shooting, because we'd have one kid shooting and then someone's holding a reflector, and some scenes we'd, you know, drop a scrim over the top just to knock them down a little bit. But to see, you know, a fourth and fifth grader doing this, that's going to stick in their head, you know. Maybe not everyone, but, you know, a couple kids are, you know, who knows if you're starting the wheels turning at an early age, they're like, this is really cool. And for them to go through the whole process of sitting in a room full of, you know, 20 rambunctious ADD kids trying to figure out how to, you know, agree on what movie to make, and then, you know, 3 months later, out comes a movie that they can sit around and watch together and show to the entire pack. It's really kind of a cool thing for them to experience, and hopefully, you know, thinking in terms of, you know, a beginning and a middle and an end to a project, it can teach them so much more than just, you know, how to make a fun project that they can you know, show their friends. But, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into it, and there's a lot of detail that has to go into it. So even if they never pick up a camera again, hopefully, you know, you've got such a cross-section of interest in scouting that they'll take the experience and go with it.
Well, and there's your next couple of books, you know, Storyboarding for Dummies and Video for Dummies.
You know, there is one in the store that I was looking at that was iPhone video and still, I was like, still in video for dummies.
Really?
And I was like, God, what a great title, because, I mean, and there's a great book called, that I even have shared with some of my college students that are called Pulling Off Your Shorts. And it's about making short films, but it's all written for high school kids.
Really?
And it's written in those short, I mean, creative people, so many of us end up in the dark room because we're not good in science and we're not good in math. And, you know, we struggle to just sit down and study for an hour, but then you get into the dark room and you know, you can spend all night in there. And so many creative people, and, you know, I see it with the students that we have. You say math to them and they get pasty and they start, you know, kind of rocking in their seat like Rain Man a little bit.
I'm doing that right now. You just...
I know. And it's like there's math involved in photography. There's lighting ratios. There's so much involved with it. But if you just break it up and you know, if you're visual about it, that you can get through it, and they can glean that and kind of come away with a solid understanding that they can apply to photography in anything. That, you know, it's a great time. I think that technology has gotten to the point where it is so instantaneous that students that, or just individuals, anyone, I think, they can look at the back of the camera and see if it's good, bad, or indifferent. That, you know, that everyone's fan, everything from commercial work just to your family pictures. You know, if you're shooting in a hospital room, you know, a newborn, the lighting there is always horrible, but being able to look on the back of the camera, you're going to have better baby pictures to share with your friends, because you can see, you know, you're going to shoot until you get something good on the back of the camera. So I think the technology is there for a reason, and it can have devastating effects on the industry or on some of the practitioners if they haven't embraced it as a, you know, it's coming. It's going to be here. You know, we're not going to be able to shoot film much longer. So shoot it while you can, because, you know, the problem's not going away, but there are all these new solutions coming. And, you know, check out blogs and read stuff. And there's so much information out there, and there's so much you know, the internet is such a conduit, and there's a lot of bad information out there, but read it all and you'll figure out what's good and bad.
So what's the next project for you then?
You know what's funny? I was sharing something with a student about I do a class in the summer called Modern Alternative. I wanted it to be called Modern Alternative Practices, but it was too vague, so we had to add the word photographic in there. So now it's like so long, no one can say it. So the nickname for it is BCS, which is Building Cool. We'll say stuff exactly. Building Cool Stuff, and it is a it's kind of an alternative class, but for, you know, we're not doing, you know, all the old processes. We start out with, we look at a lot of the Winston Link photographs on how he lit, you know, he'd go into a town and you know, put 300 flash bulbs in place, all hardwired, and, you know, a train would come through and he'd shoot one sheet of 4x5. So we kind of study him a little bit, and then we say, okay, but look at the tools we have now, and then we go out to we've done it in my here in my hometown of Brookfield, and shot all around, and we went down to the windmill farms that are just south of Chicago, and used some of his kind of applied these 50-year-old techniques in a modern day. And then we also build stuff. We'll take some old Polaroids apart and get the lenses out and make our own lens babies, or we'll take apart these old folding cameras that you can get at garage sales and stuff, and make kind of a lens baby that doesn't look like everyone's shooting a lens baby. You can kind of see lens baby photographs, and I go, oh, look, you know, they bought a lens baby, great. But when you do the same kind of process with this, you know, one of my friends, and honestly one of my favorite photographers, James Godman, has stuff on his website that is incredibly cool looking and very unique. And it was made with a 1913 folding camera that he cut the back off, and then you, with a drill press, you can drill out a body block and then make a flange where you can put these in and shoot them on a modern digital camera. And it looks so much more different and unique, so you can come out with something that doesn't look, you know, when you show, even people that don't know what a lens baby is, they're going to look at it and go, yeah, okay, I've kind of seen that look before. We also build a lot of lighting stuff where we, you know, I mean, light is light. The size of it is paramount, but there's so much you can just build. There's so many different ways that you can kind of customize your gear. We talk about how they photographed the space shuttle and able to get the back in the film days, they'd have to set the camera on the, you know, near the shuttle and then get off the grounds, and it would sit overnight. Well, dew would fall, and if they didn't have some way to protect the lens, the pictures would all have dew on the front. So what they would do is they would take a coffee can lid, and with a rubber band hook, they would flip up the film advance knob and hook a rubber band to it, and then the other side to a coffee can lid. So as soon as the motor drive started firing, the first frame would rip the coffee can cover off and exposing the lens. That solution is practically free, and it is so brilliant. If you can get students to think like that, and anyone to think like that, you know, coupled with the technology that we have today and these products that you know, Leaf and Phase and Canon and Nikon are coming out with, the next 10 years and 20 years of photography is going to be, you know, astronomical of what people are going to do. So that's a really long way to get around to. I was sharing some images with a student on some of James Godman's cameras. And I was thinking, man, I've got so much of this stuff. It'd be really fun to do a book of just easy hacks that you can do in your basement. Because everything I do is generally in the basement, real basic tools. Dremel is the greatest photographer's best friend. And how to use the hardware store instead of the camera store to make images. So I'm going to start putting a proposal together for that, because there's so much fun stuff out there that I think people would really enjoy kind of goofing around with.
So DIY photography for dummies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, some people are afraid to go to the hardware store for a solution.
I'm not. I'm working on two DIY things myself, trying to figure out.
Hey, we got to talk. I want to see them. Maybe we'll put them in the book.
Hey, why not?
I was included in a book years ago. It's called Pinholes, Panoramas, and other things. It was by Rotovision, which is, I think, the European focal press. And I was taking those 3D cameras, the original 3D cameras, which were actually a lenticular. It was the Nimsol 3D that had four lenses across.
Right.
Well, that's like a 3.5-inch gate that you can, you got to get in with the Dremel and cut out the separator. That will probably take you two to get one good one without hacking out the advance wheel. But I took apart, I hacked one out, and then you put a Holga front end on it. And the fall off from the Holga lens was perfectly matched to the width of that opening. And so it would go black on the edges with this wonderful vignette. It would go out of focus. And that was included in the book, and in that book. And it was funny because there were people in the book that were, you know, had built these amazing aluminum cameras, and they, you know, it took, you know, 4 months machining this out, and I'm down here with a hacksaw and a Dremel, and I'm, you know, a chapter away from this guy. And it was really fun. I'm like, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
Well, Dirk, I really appreciate you being on the show today and giving me your thoughts about what might end up in my attic.
I hope so. I hope so. Shoot film, shoot it while we can, because it's numbered, man.
It is. I want to point out to people listening today that we post this interview on www.lensflare35.com and on www.currentphotographer.com, as well as iTunes. My guest today has been photographer Dirk Fletcher. I want to thank him for being on the show, and I also want to thank all of you for listening to Lens Flare 35. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is part of the Photocast Network. Get more great shows about photography at photocastnetwork.com. photocastnetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Martin Bailey, a photographer based in Japan, and I run a weekly photography podcast and blog that I know you're going to love. I explain my techniques, thought processes, and the artistic decisions behind my images, all illustrated with my own real-world examples. Search for Martin Bailey Photography Podcast in iTunes or visit martinbaileyphotography.com for links. See you then.
Interested in more great photography discussions? Join me, Jim Goldstein, the host of the Exif and Beyond podcast, for thought-provoking discussions on timely news, trends, and technologies with amazing photographers and industry thought leaders. Subscribe to Exif and Beyond on iTunes and be sure to visit exifandbeyond.com.
Are you a new media photographer? Well, if you publish to the web, Flickr, Facebook, Twitter, and the thousands of other options, then the answer is yes. Join me, your host, Rosh Sillars, for your show about new media, social media, and digital media for the photographer. NewMediaPhotographer.com.
Thanks, everyone, for listening today. Remember, for more on-demand podcast articles and information, please visit our website at www.lensflare35.com or subscribe to LensFlare 35 on iTunes. We'd also love to hear from you, your comments, feedback, and questions. Send us an email at editor@lensflare35.com, make a comment on the site, or write a review on iTunes.